What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to this special live recording of the Cynic Podcast, coming to you from the Story Bookworm right here in the great city of Beijing. Let's hear you make some noise, Beijing. Happy Lantern Festival, everybody. We're really pleased that you decided to spend it with us. Thank you to David Moser for doing the technical stuff. The Seneca Podcast is a weekly discussion of current affairs in China produced in partnership with SubChina, which is a great way to keep on top of all the important news from China in just a few minutes a day with a free email newsletter, which I now edit, so forgive the self-promotion, and a smartphone app and a website. Sadly, Kaiser Gore can't join us today. He had an air ticket mix-up. And will only be on the plane tomorrow morning. And I know you were promised Simon and Garfunkel, and you just got Garfunkel. But Kaiser sends his deepest regrets. And as we have a true rock star of journalism as guest today, I trust you will forgive us. Today we're going to talk about China's foreign relations in a time of tremendous uncertainty. With us to talk about it is someone who's been covering international relations for many years, Jane Perlez of the New York Times. Welcome to Seneca, Jane.
Thank you.
So, although, or perhaps because Jane grew up in America's implacable Antipodean foe, Australia... I'm glad you follow the news. She's been writing for the New York Times since 1981. She first came to this fair city in 2012, or she first came for the New York Times, this first fair city in 2012, to be the paper's first chief diplomatic correspondent. And last year, she became the Beijing bureau chief. Jane won the Pulitzer Prize in 2009 for her coverage of the war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. She has covered wars, diplomacy, and foreign policy from Somalia to Poland to Indonesia and many places in between, right?
Sort of.
Since moving to Beijing, she's written about everything from China's space program to the Dixie Mission, which is the group of Americans sent to Mao Zedong's revolutionary base at Yan'an, who hoped to establish good relations between the U.S. and the soon-to-be-victorious Chinese communists. But much of her reporting has focused on China's foreign policy, in particular its relations with the United States and its Asian neighbors. So she is the ideal interpreter for us as we try to understand Chinese foreign relations in the age of the Orange Emperor. Welcome to Seneca again, Jane. So I'd like to start with a question about the phone call. So on, sorry, I really don't want to talk about Donald Trump, but we have to. So on Wednesday, news broke that Donald Trump had, as the White House statement put it, provided a letter to Xi Jinping full of bromides about how, you know, let's get along. And then on, Thursday, New York time, like Friday here, the news broke that there was a phone call between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. What's your take on what went on?
Well, a lot of negotiating went on, and I wish we knew what really went on in those negotiations. So the drama started, as you know, when Trump's people organized a phone call from the president of Taiwan, President Tsai on December the 2nd. And the Chinese immediately reacted with very firm statement that the One China policy was non-negotiable, no questions to be asked about it. After that, you know, and then Trump did a tweet saying, in an interview saying, One China policy should be negotiable because maybe I can get something from them on South China Sea and trade and a few other things. And the Chinese stood very firm. I think that the Chinese just decided to see how good a negotiator he was, and I think they turned out to be the better negotiators. They were very patient. They were very firm. I think Jared Kushner did the main negotiating. I think there's a question mark right there. Kushner's real estate firm is in negotiations with Angbang, the big insurance company, for a major infusion of capital into his big project, into his big building on Fifth Avenue. So it's certainly in Jared Kushner's interest to have a stable U.S.-China relationship, and I think that that was the starting point. And then gradually it began to dawn on responsible people around Trump, like Tillerson and Mattis, that the Chinese were serious about One China policy, that it was non-negotiable. And then Jared sent his wife and child to the embassy 10 days ago. And the Chinese were very effusive about that and showed it all over social media and television, and this was an example of the Chinese being very nice to the Americans, encouraging them along without paying anything themselves. And then come the Happy New Year letter, and again the Chinese were very happy to receive this, encouraging the Americans to come along, and then finally the phone call. I think the bottom line is that Tillerson was at the White House just before the phone call, pointing out that the risks were too high to muck around with One China. And Donald Trump, the great negotiator, had to step back and swallow a little bit of pride.
So
that makes sense?
That does make sense. It makes complete sense. It doesn't. Can I ask you about, there was a recent report by a bipartisan task force on U.S.-China relations that was put together by the Asia Society and the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California in San Diego. And the task force included a number of luminaries in China studies, journalism, and foreign policy, including former Assistant Secretary of State Susan Shirk, Orville Schell, and Charlene Barshefsky, who was a key negotiator on the U.S. side in China's entry into the World Trade Organization at the turn of the century. And that report is kind of nuanced. I don't know if nuanced is the right word.
It's very boring.
It's boring.
Very predictable.
It's predictable. So it urges Trump to take a tougher line on China, but It also advises caution about upsetting the delicate balance of the status quo on issues like Taiwan and other Chinese sensitivities. What do you make of that report, aside from, clearly, you said, boring?
Well, I think that after many American elections, there are a bunch of worthies get together and, well, I should say before the election, they get together and they travel the world. I noticed that they stopped at Oxford University and Sunnylands in California and a couple of other really high-toned places to write their report. I shouldn't be so sarcastic, but really, it's a group of worthies who do know a lot about China, but the report is very unadventurous. Winston Lord, a former American ambassador here who actually came here with Kissinger when Kissinger negotiated the opening of China as a young China expert and then later became ambassador, he was the only one who wrote a dissent. They tackled the big topics, obviously, trade, economy, South China Sea, North Korea. But on North Korea, Winston Lord wrote one dissent saying that he really thought the United States should rapidly impose secondary Iran-like sanctions on North Korea and China that would hurt China as a way of trying to solve this North Korean problem, which is the most immediate problem that I think faces the Trump crowd. Trump was briefed on the North Korea problem and their ability to be able to hit the United States with nuclear weapons by soon, 5 years, 7 years, take your pick, according to the experts. He was briefed on this by Obama shortly after the election. Many people have said in the past few weeks that North Korea is the most important issue. Winston Lord reckons that the United States should put hard and fast sanctions on North Korea and China to try and force Kim Jong-un to make a choice between his survival, which he values above all else, and his nuclear weapons. Now, whether that's the right route to go, I'm not saying it is, but at least it was, you know, a slightly different way of thinking than the usual. Let's appoint a high-level channel to discuss this, which is basically most of the solutions in this report. I think we've had enough high-level dialogues between the United States and China in the last 8 years during the Obama administration, and there really has to be some different approaches. The only problem is the person who's in charge of the different approaches is Trump, and that's not the answer.
Okay, let's take a tour of the neighborhood. So what's your take on Beijing's calculus for some of the kind of regional problems in light of, you know, President Trump? So maybe we can start with Japan. Japan, of course, is justifiably nervous about Trump, and Shinzo Abe made sure to meet with him during the transition. And in fact, I think right now is enjoying Trump's hospitality, possibly at the expense of the American taxpayer, or possibly Trump is making money from it, but at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. During the campaign, Trump was very critical of Japan, calling it a free rider and seeming to waive on U.S. treaty commitments. And many a reputable source also says that Trump just doesn't like Japan. Some of his early business reversals were dealt him by Japanese competitors. Now Mattis is talking about standing shoulder to shoulder with its allies in East Asia. And we've just had the phone call between Trump and Xi Jinping. How is Beijing reacting to this?
I think this is one area. Japan is one area where Beijing is probably not very happy. For reasons that we can talk about in a minute, I think they must be very happy about the rest of the region, in particular about Australia. But on Japan, I think that responsible people around Trump, meaning basically Tillerson and Mattis, I don't know of any others, have told him, look, we've got to keep the troops there. Japan does pay a fair share of the cost of those troops. Maybe it can pay a bit more and probably will. But you really need Japan. And I think that's what's happening as we speak. Abe is and Trump are playing golf in Florida. Abe has some interesting ideas about helping Trump with his infrastructure building in the United States. I mean, if I was Trump, I'd be mortified that I had to take help from another country. But anyway, Abe's offering this. And I think Abe was very clever to go there very early on and talk to Trump, because Abe had spent a lot of political capital in getting the TPP through the Diet, and Trump did him the disfavor of abandoning TPP. But I think all in all, I think the Chinese must be a little bit worried about the mended bridges between Japan and the United States.
Okay. Australia, the place you grew up. The Prime Minister of your erstwhile home was the recipient of what seems to have been Trump's most hostile call to date with a foreign leader. Yet Australia has been one of America's closest allies for decades, loyally following the U.S. into ill-advised wars, being one of the five eyes of the Anglophone intelligence community, and supporting the U.S. through thick and thin. Nonetheless, how should Australia respond to China's rise? This has been a subject of vigorous debate. perhaps most prominently Hugh White, who is a highly respected strategic analyst with a lot of experience in Australia's defense and intelligence sectors, has been arguing for quite some time that, if I may reduce a fairly complex argument to a soundbite, that Australia needs to come to some kind of accommodation with China that America may not wholly approve of.
It's happening as we speak. I was just in Australia, and I couldn't believe my eyes or ears. I think the Chinese have been very, very clever in Australia. It's a big prize for China, and they are winning. The confidence in Australia in the American alliance is weakening, and the Trump phone call just weakened it further. It was really very foolish, because the American alliance among the population is the polls show 45% support. Soon that'll be over. Soon that will change. It will get less and less. Why? Because the Australians see less and less benefit out of the relationship with the United States. As you mentioned, they've fought alongside the United States since World War I. The Americans came to their help in World War II, but then the Australians fought in Vietnam and Iraq, and now they have planes over Syria. They don't see what they're getting for these military involvements with the United States, but they see what they're getting from China, selling all their wine, selling all their beef, selling iron ore and coal and natural gas that has kept Australia out of recession for more than a decade. Maybe
it's made it, what do they call it, the happy country.
Well,
the lucky country.
In the 1960s, it was called the lucky country. It's a kind of old-fashioned phrase now, but maybe China has made it the luckier country. But the Trump phone call was really foolish.
So I didn't originally plan on asking this, but since we have like a front row full of Kiwis, how about New Zealand?
Well, New Zealand, maybe we should ask the New Zealanders, but I I have a sense it's a similar pattern. They also have been historically very close military and security allies of the United States, being part of the Five Eyes, which means that their intelligence services share everything, or almost everything, with the United States. The New Zealanders are a little different, you understand. They welcomed some Greenpeace boats a few years ago, and you know there was a big fuss and there was a big breach in the alliance. But I think they're back in good odor in Washington. But they're in very good odor here in China, because they have beautiful milk that they bring here. They have beautiful wine and a few other things that the Chinese just love, and which keeps the New Zealand economy really robust, so much so that Peter Thiel wants to go down there and retire.
So you're seeing Australia and New Zealand shifting closer to China?
Definitely.
Okay. What about the Philippines? The Philippines is a really interesting case, because, you know, just last year there was this arbitration. But the new president, Duterte, has seemed to have completely reversed the previous government's policies and has cozied up to China in quite a remarkable way. I mean, even to the extent of inviting China. It's not quite clear if it's the Chinese Navy or sort of civilian kind of fishermen people to police pirates off the Philippines coast, and has generally tried to make China feel fairly comfortable around the Philippines. How do you think China's relations with the Philippines are going to fare in the next couple of years, especially bearing in mind Trump in the United States?
I think the Philippines, you know, I was probably a little strident about Australia and New Zealand. I mean, don't take me too seriously on that. I mean, but I do think that they are big prizes. I think the Philippines is a little different. It's a little different. Duterte has shown every sign of just telling the United States to get lost and embracing Beijing. I saw him when he came here to Beijing last fall, and he was certainly very solicitous of Xi Jinping and vice versa. But I think we have to remember that there are, I don't know the numbers, but there are many, many Filipino workers in the United States who send remittances back to back to the Philippines, and they are very loyal to the United States. I think there are a lot of people in the Philippines who are pro-American from many years ago, even though America was a colonial power there. So I think it's not quite so clear in the Philippines. I think also De Lorenzo, the defense minister, seems to still want to have the Americans have access to the Philippine bases. I don't think that will be cut off, which is important. And things aren't quite settled at the Scarborough Shoal, which is the island in the South China Sea, where Duterte wants his fishermen to have access to inside the shoal to get fishing rights, and the Chinese haven't given that yet. So I think there'll be a lot of to and fro. I don't expect the Philippines to become a total Chinese satellite in the next few months. It'll take a bit more work.
What about the rest of Southeast Asia? I mean, Vietnam under Obama has been moving closer to the U.S., as has Burma, Myanmar. Thailand in recent months seems to be moving closer to China. All of these countries seem to have escaped Donald Trump's notice because probably he can't pronounce them. sorry, this is kind of partisan, I guess, but, you know, fuck him. But do the aggressive noises about the South China Sea that have been coming from the Trump government, do they sound reassuring or frightening to Southeast Asian ears? I mean, do you think people in Bangkok and Hanoi, are they kind of freaking out because they don't know what Trump is thinking, or are they thinking that this guy will stand up to China and it'll be good for them? What's going on?
With aggressive noises in the South China Sea, I mean, the Australians are freaking out about that. They don't want to go and join the United States in having a blockade against the artificial islands. In fact, they told me they wouldn't even dream of it. So if they're against it and they've got the military hardware to do it and treaties that almost oblige them to join the Americans there, I can't imagine what the Vietnamese and the Thais think. Look, Thailand has been moving closer to China since the military junta went in, and I think that that's going to become even more of a Chinese-influenced country. Vietnam is bitterly disappointed with Trump's cancellation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they thought that was going to help the economy. So that's gone by the by. Very, very harmful. Laos and Cambodia, they're basically... Yeah, they've been in the Chinese camp. Malaysia is moving closer to China. So I would say all of Southeast Asia, excluding Singapore and Indonesia, are in a very good position for China.
Okay, let's move north to the icy wastes of Russia. So one possibility that some commentators have raised is that Trump's apparently insalubrious relationship with Putin is in fact a cunning strategy of triangulation to contain China, that just as Nixon and Kissinger cozied up to Mao, partly or perhaps mostly as a way to contain the USSR, a closer relationship between Russia and the US will reduce China's geopolitical operating space. Does this sound at all likely to you?
I'm not so sure. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Trump not to do what he'd like to do with Russia. And it's a bit of a mystery, you know. I mean, Trump said the other day he'd never met Putin. So what is this love affair? Is it a love affair between Flynn and some of the Putin operatives? It may turn out to be that. Or it may turn out, if we ever see Trump's tax returns, that he really was investing or doing financial deals with people in Russia. But in the end, I think that there'll be a lot of pressure from the Senate, from other areas in the United States, for Trump not to consummate this Russia-United States deal that is supposed to fight ISIS and contain China. I think that there'll be instead a kind of more what's fashionably called a multipolar world.
Maybe you don't want to answer this, but like, I get the feeling sometimes that the love affair with Trump and Russia is kind of racist, basically.
Oh, definitely.
It's like the yellow communists are not cool, but the white communists are cool. Kind of like, do you think there's any, I mean, am I wrong?
I was just in Hong Kong with my colleagues, correspondents from the region for the New York Times. We had a yearly conference where we get together, and can you believe it, we talk about future stories. But one of the one of my colleagues who was there is going to join us in the Beijing Bureau. He was recently the Moscow correspondent, and his conclusion is just that it's basically an alliance of a racist outlook, that, you know, we're the white guys that can beat the hordes elsewhere.
All right, more yellow people. Korean Peninsula. During the campaign, Trump seemed to think that Pyongyang's aggressiveness, its push to develop long-range ballistic missiles, and of course its continuing nuclear ambitions, were all things that China could deal with if it wanted to, and that managing of North Korea was really just a matter of deal-making with Beijing, that you could kind of say to Beijing, sort those North Koreans out. But what is likely to happen on the Korean Peninsula under a Trump presidency?
Good question. I do wonder what went down in this. This would be a little convoluted, but this one China backed down a couple of days ago. You have to wonder, you know, did Trump and his people really just say, okay, it's one China policy, and not get anything from the Chinese? Did they not really say, we need some give, we want something from you in return for publicly supporting your one China policy? And I wonder if the Chinese said to Trump, okay, well, we'll do what we can for you with Kim Jong-un, and we'll try and persuade him to pull back on his nuclear weapons, which would have been a nice gesture by the Chinese, but by the way, totally worthless, because I don't think the Chinese can live up to it. But I do wonder if there was some kind of talk on the North Korea front there. I think that the Chinese just want the status quo to a point. They seem to think that if Kim Jong-un develops these nuclear weapons, he's not going to turn them on China. Why they're so confident, I'm not so sure, and why they seem to be so blasé about having a fully weaponized neighbor with whom they have a fake alliance on their border, I'm not quite sure. But I wonder if the solution isn't just direct talks between the United States and the North Koreans. I mean, the North Koreans would like that. They'd like a treaty that formally ended the North Korean the Korean War. They'd like to talk to the Americans across the table. Maybe Trump will risk it. Do you think that's crazy?
No, I don't. I mean, I actually think that the North Koreans have wanted that for a very long time, and but it's kind of not a shibboleth. I don't know what's the word. I mean, you kind of can't talk about that in the U.S.
But, you know, Trump is such a...
Maybe he can do it.
An unorthodox person.
Maybe he's the guy who can actually do it. Yeah. I mean, there will be silver linings, I think.
Will possibly. There?
Maybe.
Possibly.
Please. Will there be silver linings? I hope. So one of the most controversial and I think disgusting things Trump has done in his three-week-old presidency is to ban entry to the U.S. by people from seven Muslim-majority countries. And, I mean, aside from the fact that I think it's just fucking despicable, as a green card holder who lives in the United States now, I suddenly realized, oh, like, what if they decide South Africa is, like, dodgy? And after, like, I'm in Beijing, I'm supposed to go back next Thursday, maybe I'll get to the airport and they'll be like, oh, sorry, Mr. Goldcorn, you know, he has the anal probe, or, you know, whatever they do. So
don't worry, I'm worried too. I'm a green card holder and I've got an Australian passport, which is better than
yours.
Oh,
that's very dodgy. Yeah, that's very dodgy. You, as I said earlier, you are an implacable foe.
I also have a British passport. That's also supposed to be...
Well, anal probe for you, Jane. So, sorry.
May Winty.
So there was widespread outcry about this ridiculous executive order in the United States and beyond. But it was also supported very strongly by Trump's base. And Trump's tough talk about Islamic extremists and terrorists is no doubt one of the pillars of his worldview that gives him a lot of support amongst, you know, a fairly significant group of people in the United States. Even to a lot of Americans who don't find a lot else about him appealing, they kind of like the idea that he's going to get tough with Islamic extremists. So, I mean, will he see eye to eye with Xi Jinping on this? Because China has, how to put it, taken an attitude towards its Muslim population and towards terrorism that seems to be in some ways of a piece with this Donald Trump executive order to ban Muslims from 7 Muslim majority countries. I mean, how might this affect U.S.-China relations? Do you think a Trump administration and Xi Jinping's government might find some common cause here?
I don't think so, really. I mean, as you say, there seems to be some commonality. But look, there are big issues coming down the pike which are going to be very tough for China, and it's basically on trade and the economy. And this, Trump has, as much as he's based his campaign on keeping out the Muslims, he's also based his campaign on getting tough on China and imposing a border tax and demanding reciprocity. And we haven't seen that yet. I think that's partly because his economic team is not in place. But he, as we all know, he's got a Wilbur Ross is his trade person is really firm on this. Mnuchin, his treasury secretary, seems to be pretty firm on this. I think there's going to be a lot of tough demands of the Chinese to open up their economy. The Chinese are going to face tougher regulations on investment in the United States, a tougher CFIUS, which is the government board that has to approve huge overseas purchases is going to be toughened up, and I think the Chinese will have a tough time buying certain kinds of industries and companies. So I think any commonality on the Muslim front is kind of small. I don't really see that as a basis for anything terribly much. Might seem appealing to us. It doesn't really make sense to me, but I understand your point.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one more question, and then we'll take questions from the audience. And we're sticking in the Middle East because it's so horrible to work out. So will China face off against the U.S. in Israel? Last year in Cairo, Xi Jinping expressed support for East Jerusalem becoming the capital of Palestine. Trump has promised to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which will delight Israeli hardliners, but be seen as a real slap in the face by most Palestinians. Do you think this might become an issue where the U.S. and China end up having real disagreement? And does China have any kind of real commitment to the Palestinian cause?
I don't think China is interested in getting involved in the Middle East in a political way or becoming a negotiator. I mean, okay, Xi Jinping was in Davos the other day saying, "I'm Mr. Globalization. I'm the new face. I'm the new leader of the world." But the last thing he wants to do is get involved in the Middle East. He's interested in the Middle East for its oil, and he's interested in having and they're building a base in Djibouti to make sure that their navy can reach there and to make sure that the oil and energy pipeline is good from the Middle East. But I think they're going to leave the heavy lifting on Middle East problems to others. I think they've been helpful on Iran sanctions. They'll pick and choose, but I don't see any real Chinese involvement in the Middle East in the foreseeable future. I mean, China's got got to deal with the United States on these economic issues, and he's got his own political issues at home. But the Middle East is kind of periphery. It's way over here.
So before we have audience questions, is there any other kind of media bollocks we can dispel?
Huh.
Like about...
Well,
China.
I think it's... I don't know about... I feel in a way as though I haven't been... I've been disappointing and not sort of being a Trump basher.
No. you did your share. It's fine.
I do see a rough period ahead between the United States and China. Really, really rough. And I think that the countries in Southeast Asia are going to suffer for it. I think they're very nervous. And as I said, I think that the situation in Australia is really worth watching. Watch this space.
Okay. Well, now it is time for audience questions.
Let's get back to Russia. All of the major TV outlets in the United States about 5 hours ago came out with a story saying that Russia is thinking about making Edward Snowden a gift to Obama.
Could you just identify yourself, sir? So
yeah, my name is Mark Levine. And do any more?
No, that's all right. That's good enough.
Okay, so
we can look you up in the NSA database.
That's right. Okay, and then immediately following that, there were these other things saying, well, maybe this isn't really happening. But it came out, all three of the big networks immediately came out. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
I don't know anything about this, so I'm sorry. I can't really say. And by the way, it would have been a gift to Trump. You said Obama. You meant Trump.
Gift to Trump. Obama would have accepted it, too. But, yeah. So nothing? No opinion? What do you think?
Fact-based journalist.
All right. Okay.
Opinion. Sorry, I can't satisfy you.
Hi, I'm Lulu. I'm a journalist covering from Brussels for Caixin Media here. And I feel obliged to ask questions for Europeans because it's not mentioned during the questions yet. One of the sentiments I pick up from Brussels is that maybe Trump will make a lot of deals with many different countries, China, Russia, Africa, whoever. But Europe is out. That's sort of the sense of it. I wonder how... What is your take of it? Should China and the European Union have a sort of better, more a differentiated relationship in the future or not?
Well, Trump has basically said that NATO is a waste of time and the European Union is a waste of time too. But I think, again, the more sober side of his house is going to prevail. I mean, Mattis, the defense secretary, is going to insist that NATO continue to exist, but they're also going to insist that the NATO countries spend more on their defense. I mean, you know all that. I think that from China's perspective, they're going to continue to try and buy all they can from Germany in terms of acquiring high tech by buying important companies, and China may find some resistance there as Germany wakes up to finding that their valuable technology is being bought off for the advantage of China. So we'll see. I mean, I think Trump wrote off Europe, but Europe still exists. Merkel is still very strong, and presumably she'll win the election. So there'll still be a strong American-European relationship, minus Britain. And China will be in there as well. So it may not be as strong as it was between the United States and Europe. It may be sort of this multipolar situation where Europe is one part, the United States is another, and China is over here.
And a quick follow-up. Do you think Lepont have a chance?
I have no idea. I don't follow French politics.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Desmond. I also write about Okay, I write about international affairs. And I just wonder what it's like to be a MIT bureau chief here in China, and also to be more particular, because I imagine you must be very excited about things are getting tough between China and the US in the future. So I just to help you answer that question, how is it like to be a bureau chief in China? Could you explain if there's going to be a trade war, how would you work on that?
Well, fortunately, we have, I don't really want to duck your question, but I'm going to, because I'm very lucky. The New York Times has a correspondent in Shanghai, Keith Bradshaw, who spent his entire reporting career covering trade. So he's going to be doing all that nitty-gritty trade war stuff.
Jane is just in the spa bath eating caviar and drinking champagne.
No?
Yeah, not really.
I thought that's how you rolled at the New York Times.
Yeah, I wish. But Keith and I were at this correspondence meeting that I mentioned in Hong Kong, which I mentioned a little earlier. And boy, he knows he's known these Trump trade negotiators since he was covering trade in Washington 20 years ago. And when these Trump guys, Lighthizer, Munchen, Navarro, he even knew in another incarnation. So he's going to have this thing really wrapped up. And if he needs a perspective from kind of a geopolitical point of view, I can provide that. But on the nitty gritty of whether there's going to be border tax on this product or the other, that's all his. And what it's like to be a Beijing bureau chief?
The firecrackers.
That's it. It means quite a few visits to the foreign ministry to persuade them to give us more visas.
Hi, I'm Daniel Stitt. I am not a reporter. I'm just here. And
welcome. Love having non-reporters.
Great.
Real people.
Well, real, so they say. But what do you think China's end goal is with their naval buildup? Do you think they're going to be more of a regional power still? Or do you think they have sights set for a global sort of police force in the future?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first aim is to be a regional naval power, definitely. I think the goal is to make the South China Sea the China Sea. And I think the goal is to be able to protect all of Southeast Asia and into the Indian Ocean for its own interests. And as you know, they are building this base in Djibouti, which is the first, but not going to be the only one. If you read their language carefully, they do plan to build others. Not clear where yet. And in time, you know, I think they've pledged to build, they've got one aircraft carrier, and I think they've got two more under construction. So if they've got, say, four aircraft carriers and their attendant ships that go with them, that's quite a bit of naval power. So I think it's a little early right now to say when they're going to jump from being a regional power to a more global one, but in the long term, probably a global one. Depends also what the United States does. Is the United States going to build up its navy, or is it as Trump has pledged, or is the navy going to stay as it is, or slightly decline? But if the PLA gets its way, and if Xi Jinping has a third term, I would see the Chinese military getting stronger and stronger.
Hi there, I'm Lily Pike, and I work at an environmental NGO here in Beijing. I have to ask the question that's weighing on my generation in particular, which is, do you see China taking up the international mantle on climate change in the wake of Trump?
Well, I don't know about the international mantle. I think that's probably a bit of a stretch. But I do think that obviously it's no news to you, I think they're trying to be as serious as they can within the political constraints of doing some things at home to clean up the environment, and that's a good thing, isn't it? Do you think they're moving fast enough at home?
No one's moving fast enough.
Yeah. So I don't think China's going to pick up the international mantle on the environment or anything else in the next during the first Trump presidency, and God forbid if there's a second one. I just don't think they don't have the military power. To be a global power, you have to have military power, and they don't have that dominant military power by any means. You have to have a very persuasive soft power, and they certainly don't have that. Those are just two of the elements. And you've got to have a big economic power. No, they have that, but is that going to stay? So I think we're a long way off from seeing China as an international mantle, Mr. Globalization. I'm not sure that that's going to come to fruition in the next. That's not going to come to fruition in the next 4 years. In answer to your question about whether, so I don't think see them picking up the whole ballywick of the environmental program. I think they'll be supportive, but how far they'll actually push it.
But I mean, Jen, I think we have to just push back on one point. Is like it's not just weighing on your generation. We're planning to live till 150. So
I hope so. We need
it's
you.
It's weighing
on
our generation too. Okay, so just
glad we're in this together. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you a question. So you work with an environmental NGO. The new NGO law has just come down. Are you able to stay here?
What visa do you have?
So I didn't mean it in that way. I just meant since environment is a fairly neutral, good governance thing, are you able to stay? Are you able to stay?
I'm optimistic that things will work out for all the international environmental NGOs in Beijing. I don't know yet, but I'm optimistic that things will work out. I think it's an area of close cooperation for us.
Well, that shows.
I hope so, personally.
But that shows, don't you think, that the Chinese are interested in environmental good governance to a certain degree?
I believe so. I just don't know if they can fill the void.
I agree with you.
Thank you.
Hi, good evening, Salvador Perez. You already alluded to this. You mentioned.
What do you? Are you a lousy reporter? I mean, are you a good reporter and a lousy professional?
You already alluded to soft power. And so during the Trump administration, what sort of soft power competitions or increases do you think China will be taking to kind of push out the U.S. and the region?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm just going to go back to Australia if I can.
It's a lovely country.
I don't know. I left it many years ago, but I did happen just to be there. And I was really quite taken aback with how America's soft power there, and I think in other countries under Trump, is diminished so fast. There is such a loathing's not the right word, but disappointment that Trump is the president of the United States, that I think the United States' prestige is so diminished that this is really dangerous for those of us who believe that the United States, on the whole, has been huge mistakes, including the Iraq War and a few other things, but on the whole, has been a reasonable influence. So I think its influence is diminished because of Trump, and I think China is learning some lessons. I think that they're very heavy-handed, so they tend to try and infiltrate the Chinese diaspora, which is resented. They try to buy off Australian politicians. I'm now talking about the Australian situation, which is also not cool. But if they played their hand a little bit more skillfully, they could make inroads. Now, whether they will, that's another question. I don't know that a regime like this is able to. But that'll be a very interesting question, I think.
Thank you very much.
Jane, I have a question for you before the next question, which is, I left Beijing in 2015 and I now live in Nashville, Tennessee.
Trump country.
So, I know a lot of people who are Trump supporters and there are a lot of people who, I mean, don't strike me as that different from people you meet in China who kind of feel that, okay, you know, 中国就是要扶起来，中国应该很强， China should be strong. It's a very similar sentiment like a lot of people around where I live.
I agree with you. It is quite striking. I mean, you know what's really striking to me? Our office is just across the street here in San Lutun, Soho. So we've been here in San Lutun, Soho for 2 years. You're wondering why I'm talking about this. Well, all these sort of groovily dressed young Chinese, you know, more money, a lot more confidence, copying the American way of dressing and liking American culture, but boy, they are real Chinese nationalists, and they really want China to succeed, and they really want China to sort of put the United States in its corner. So, yeah, there is this kind of loggerheads coming up.
So are all our complaints about Trump just because we're kind of liberal, like pussies from the bicoastal elites?
New York, God forbid.
New York, yeah. I mean, is there something in that that, you know...
You mean, are we going to have a cultural war between the nationalists here and the Trump?
Both you and I have been really pretty anti-Trump this whole time, the last hour and 20 minutes. We've been kind of laughing at him. But, I mean, is this maybe not the normal state of human affairs? I mean, that in China, people have a certain kind of nationalism that is now finding its expression in the United States for a while.
I don't think that the Trump situation is a normal situation. And I think Trump himself would say it's not a normal situation. I mean, he prides himself on being a disruptor and changing the whole ball of wax. So, I think there is an interesting theme, though, in this idea of the national your Trump people in the red states and the surge of nationalism among young people here. I don't know where that's going to lead, but there are similar themes.
Okay, let's take another couple of questions. What's the time? Yeah, we got two or three more questions.
My name is Dali, and I'm not a journalist. So my question is, China has really, for the last few years, devoted a lot of political resources and economic resources in this One Belt, One Road policy or strategy. So my question is, what do you think is going to be the long-term impact for China in those affected countries? And how do you think that will interact with these traditional American and post-colonial interests in those countries?
Well, I think this Belt and Road project that Xi Jinping announced, I was actually in the room in Astana in Kazakhstan in September 2013 when he announced the project. I thought, gosh, Xi Jinping's going to Central Asia. I'll go along on a separate plane and see what he's got to say. And so he announced this project. I think it's actually, so far, more talk than do. And I just don't think we know where it's going to go. I mean, they say they're going to spend $1 trillion on building ports and rail and road that links Central Asia to Europe and maritime equivalent. We haven't seen it yet, and these projects are, many of them are economically not feasible, and the banks here in China are complaining privately that they don't want to fund them. So I think a bit early to tell. Sorry, I don't want to duck your question, but I think that's the situation. They haven't built these things yet, and it's surprising to me, despite all the bluster, all the PR, all the talk, that, you know, Belt and Road is China's big project. So, show us. Do you agree with that or not?
I think a lot of is probably a lot of actions being taken on a project level, and
where?
Well, Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan, you're right, is one exception, but that's a political strategic thing to try and stabilize Pakistan, and
some of that, I mean, I think was the projects were in place before the Belt and Road thing was announced. So, then they said, okay, this is part of Belt and Road. But I mean, Pakistan has been going on for like a decade.
But there, a lot of these companies are carrying with them financing capabilities, which is allows them to do more projects than what they would normally do.
Well, Gwadar Port, I mean, they've renovated Gwadar Port, but there's no connection between Gwadar Port and the border with China. And they're trying to build a road through Taliban territory. I don't quite see how they're going to do that.
So should we say two more questions? Three more questions. Okay.
Hi, my name is Cooper Boss. I'm not a journalist.
Is it, how did this become a thing?
What, I don't know. It's like I asked. It's my fault.
It became a trend. you alluded earlier to the fact that China, with the increasing presence of their naval force buildup, especially regarding their aircraft carriers and the like, becoming a significant regional power to be reckoned with. What particular events, or do you think that it's a rather a conglomeration of events that will lead to China becoming an international force to be reckoned with, globally speaking?
I tried to say I thought they'd become a regional military power, but I doubted that they would become an international military power for quite a while. So
if and when?
I have no idea.
Okay. Fine.
I mean, you know, the economy could crash here tomorrow. I'm exaggerating. It's not true.
Right.
But I mean, you can't
foresee that.
I can't foresee that.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Sure.
Hi, Jane. I know many seasoned journalists are sitting over here. So as a lousy one, I can ask the one of those seasoned sitting in the front. Ken Wei from CCTV, now called CGTN. I'm a big fan of you because last time when the state visit from President Xi to Washington, you wrote many wonderful stories. Very interesting.
Thank you very much.
Quick,
but you know why?
Questions.
You know, they weren't wonderful stories, but I did do a sort of a little notebook following Xi around the United
when
States.
When I say wonderful, I didn't say propagandic. I'm just saying wonderful stories.
But I just want to explain something. I was able to write those stories because the Chinese foreign ministry made themselves available. And I think they realized that when they made themselves available and we reporters could actually ask questions and get answers and they opened up a little bit, they actually got some coverage, which was a little bit more human. I think they learned a lot from that, and we learned a lot from it.
I saw you and the spokesperson, Liu Kang, was sitting in the corner. I get really jealous of you at that moment. But anyway, you wrote wonderful stories for us. Anyway,
that I don't remember.
So, okay. So, quick questions. One is, I understand right now in Washington Press Corps, many news organizations have problems get access to the White House. We remember over the past two big occasions, only New York Daily and also Fox News. Is New York Times worried about the future access of information considering this administration? I mean, right now you could interview the former officials, but
Tianwei, it's kind of like a Chinese foreign ministry briefing, right?
Well, no, it's not. It's not. Because we cannot always compare pears to apple. But I do want to know what is going on in the Big Apple. So that's one small question. And the second question, very small one also, is can we at this point with seasoned journalists as you, and I saw Melinda over there, my friend over there, and some of the others, be able to figure out what is the decision-making process at this White House? I know this is chaotic, but
Beijing. But, they're over there.
I know. But I mean, 18 days passed. Can we see a little bit sign of things?
Thank a little you. What of things?
A little bit signs of logic, or are they streamlining a little bit?
No logic. No logic.
Is this Saturday Night Live or what? Thank you very much, James.
It's not a sign of logic.
And I love your show.
Well, I mean, what a question. You ask whether the New York Times has access. I mean, we're the failing New York Times of fake news, don't you know?
Fake news.
Look, I'm here and they're all there. we have a couple of amazing political reporters, Maggie Haberman and Glenn Thrush, who covered the Trump campaign to, and before that have covered politics, national politics and presidential campaigns for many years. And they are totally amazing. And they have covered, I think, the first, 18, 20 days of the White House in an incomparable way, I mean, plus others as well. But there are a couple of reporters who do have, who can get their phone calls returned, who do talk to people. So I think we do have a reasonable idea of what's going on, and you've seen it reported in the New York Times. So even though we're the failing New York Times of fake news, we're still able to get information. You had another question. Oh, well, I mean, it's interesting. We'll see who wins. It's going to be between Bannon, who's sort of a few yards away from the Oval Office, who I understand, I don't know if it's actually true, but there are reports yesterday that he had turned down Tillerson's choice for Deputy Secretary of State, Elliot Abrams, that Bannon had vetoed this. Elliot Abrams, yes. So how long is Tillerson going to put up with Bannon's veto power? I do think, though, in the end, that Tillerson and Mattis are, you know, experienced people. I mean, running Exxon is like running a major country in the world. So, you know, one assumes that they are going to prevail, or if they don't, they're going to leave.
They are adults, even if you don't like their kind of
correct
pro oil right-wing choices, but at least they are adults.
I think that Tillerson will be, I think he's going to shed his Exxon mantle, and I think he'll be, probably he could be a very good Secretary of State in the mold of George Shultz. I mean, I covered the State Department, I'll be very quick about this, in the late 90s and early 2000s. I had been a foreign correspondent. And the executive editor came to where I was and said, okay, you've got to come back to Washington and cover the State Department. So I did it screaming and yelling. But a very good friend said, you have to read George Shultz's memoirs. He was the Secretary of State under Reagan. It's an amazing book. I mean, it's very, very relevant today. Do you know what he says in there? He says that every afternoon he would have to get in his car at the State Department and drive over to the White House to undo the damage that Poindexter and Allen and the other crazies who were in the White House as national security advisors had put in Reagan's ear in the morning. And he would go over as the adult in the afternoon and undo all of that stuff. And because he was the adult, he mostly succeeded. So one assumes that that's going to be, one hopes that that's going to be the pattern here, that they prevail. Otherwise, I can't see how, as men of experience, they can stay there. So Trump's going to have to make a choice. And I suspect that he's going to make the choice with Mattis and Tillerson, because he has in the first few days of his administration. Actually, when you look at it very coldly, he's embracing Japan, even though he dissed Japan during the campaign. He made the phone call to Beijing. He's done various other things that sort of put him back more into the mainstream. How long that's going to stick, and I think it will probably stick enough to save us all from disaster.
Maybe they can go in the morning, I guess.
I think that Tillerson and Mattis will be over there in the afternoon undoing the trouble that done in the morning.
Is this our last question?
Okay.
So you have a huge responsibility here.
Okay. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. My name is Chao Yi, and I'm a reporter too, but I'm based in New York. So during the election night, I was at Hillary's victory party. And during that live broadcast, like, I remember, I'm not sure, like, NBC or CNN was, like, interviewing one girl from Michigan, I think. And then when she talked about, you know, Trump going to make America great again, then all these people around me started to say, what an idiot. Does she know what she's talking about? And then at that moment, I feel like, wow, okay. And I'm a foreigner, I'm Chinese, and I was there to cover the event.
Who are you covering it for?
I come for Global Taishin. And after the election, I visit Janesville,
in Wisconsin, Jensville. At that place, it's a Trump place too. So I met a lot of people whose life been impacted by the GM plant get closed, and they have all these problems, and they share what they thought about Trump, about the economy and everything. At that moment, I start to, you know, to realize the other, another America that I don't really understand. Like, because I studied Syracuse, Maxwell, and I started work, I based in New York, and that was an America that I don't think I understand.
You're surrounded by bi-coastal elites, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Right. And the after that experience, I wrote a story about that, and I after that I watched a documentary. It was about a divided America. And one of the feeling I got is that U.S. is not like one country, but a country with like two group of people, and they have different methods to get informations. Especially like in that documentary, they show all this like right-wing media or like radios. They got all this information fit into all this group of people that look at Obama a different way, look at American politics in a different way, look at the issues in different ways. And my question is, like, you know, in this new era, Breitbart or Fox News, they're gonna got a lot of like new access to this information competition. And as New York Times, as you work for New York Times, did you see
the failing New York Times?
I love New York Times. And my question is like, in this new time, new era, what's New York Times plans to do to cover the American news to expand your reader? And do you believe that media can, like, you know, write information, facts can really bring America together, be one country instead of being, you know, a divided two country?
I'm here in Beijing. You have to ask my bosses how they're going to cover the answers. I'm sorry, I can't really answer that.
But as a green card holder, how do you, you know, like,
My being a green card holder doesn't really have anything to do with anything.
No. Like, how do you feel about this divided country? I was just curious about, like,
I'm in China to cover China. I really can't give you a sensible answer about the United States, but Jeremy lives there at the moment, and maybe he can.
Yeah. How do you think about that?
Yeah. Thanks, Jane. Put it on me.
Good trick.
Yeah, it's not easy. I think it's impossible to unite the different opinions currently in the United States. People are in their bubbles, and that's just what we have to deal with. Most of my American friends that I met in Beijing are from California or the Northeast, and I currently live in a place that they all think is like full of terrible rednecks, even though it's not completely. And I think it's not very easy. It's not that different from the way Beijingers think of Weidiran. Like in Beijing, like most Beijingers or people who have good jobs in Beijing look down on anyone who doesn't have a good job or isn't from Beijing. And you have the same thing in the United States. I mean, this is a global phenomenon. My hometown, Johannesburg, South Africa, is the same. So the world is f***ed.
Let me say this though. The failing New York Times with fake news is really happy.
Failing. Sad. Yeah. Sad. So sad.
We're quite happy about Donald Trump. We've gained 250,000 new subscriptions since Election Day. And every time he mentions the failing New York Times, we get more.
Failing. Sad.
So keep it up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let us give a huge round of applause to Jane Pallas. Rockstar foreign correspondent.
To Jeremy.
Rockstar foreign correspondent. Jane Pallas, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy, and welcome back to Beijing, your real home.
I love it. You know, when I arrived here on Tuesday night, it was like polluted, and I got out of the plane, I was like, oh God, I love that smell. It's so, oh, I like it so much. And then it cleared up, and it was like all this blue sky
I mean, you're in a red state in the United States. You should come back to Beijing.
I should, yeah. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Jane. Another round of applause for Jane.
The Cynica podcast is powered by SupChina and produced by Kaiser Gula and Jeremy Goldcorn. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. Special thanks this week to Peter Goff from the fabulous Bookworm in Beijing and to David Moser for tech support. Thanks also to Anla Cheng and Sarai Darabi from SupChina. And apologies that I wasn't able to make it back to Beijing in time for our show with Jane Perlez. Drop us an email at cynica@supchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/cynicapodcast. And follow us on Twitter at cynicapodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.